court, State of Hawaii, is not even me.
Please call the case.
Case number SCWC 1165, in re arbitration between Hawaii State Teachers Association and Department of Education. Arguing for the petitioner, Robert T. Nakasugi. Arguing for the respondent, Rebecca L. Covert. Argument on the merits.
All right. Good morning, Mr. Nakasugi and Ms. Covert. Are you both ready to proceed today?
Yes.
All right. And Mr. Nakasugi, you have 10 minutes for rebuttal, so we give a warning light at that point in your argument. Ms. Covert, we will give you a warning light with 5 minutes to go. Very well. Please proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Chief Justice Rechtenwald and Honorable Associate Justices of the Hawaii Supreme Court. My name is Robert Nakatsuji, and I'm a Deputy Solicitor General in the Appellate Division of the Department of the Attorney General. I represent the State of Hawaii Department of Education in this case. May it please the Court, in this case there are both procedural and substantive issues. I'd like to very quickly address the procedural issues and then spend most of my time on the substantive issues. On the procedural issues, the ICA ruled against the state in this case primarily because of the binding effect that it gave to the October 1st, 2010 judgment. The ICA's approach in this case was fundamentally inconsistent. The ICA recognized that it had appellate jurisdiction because of the filing of the motion to alter or amend, which allowed the circuit court to amend the October 1st judgment and enter a truly final judgment, which was the February 24th judgment. But then inexplicably, the ICA relied on the October 1st judgment to invalidate the additional orders on interest that were added to the February 24th judgment to make it final. Your Honor, our position is that the February 24th final judgment was the true final judgment, and the October 1st judgment was interlocutory and subject to modification. And the circuit court did nothing wrong in ruling on the 10% judgment issue, 10% interest issue. Now, even if the court disagrees with me on the procedural issues, this court can and should address the substantive issues. The substantive issues deal with prejudgment interest and sovereign immunity, which are questions of subject matter jurisdiction. And subject matter jurisdiction can be addressed by the court at any time, sua sponte. Moreover, the substantive issues in this case are extremely important. This case involves a conflict between two significant and highly developed areas of law, arbitration law and sovereign immunity law. The substantive issues in this case deserve to be fully addressed. And with all due respect to the ICA, I believe the ICA's analysis was cursory and not as full as it should have been. On the substantive issues, the ICA held that the state waived its sovereign immunity when it agreed to arbitration and entered into a contract with HSTA. However, it is well settled black letter sovereign immunity law that a general waiver of sovereign immunity, such as for arbitrations or for contracts, is not enough to waive sovereign immunity as to interest. There has to be a specific waiver as to interest. Furthermore, the only relevant exception to the state's immunity to prejudgment interest is under HRS section 661-8, which requires an express stipulation as to interest in the contract. In this case, there was no express stipulation. The arbitrator implied inclusion of interest in the contract. In doing
that, is authority? Isn't that what he's supposed to do?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Isn't that what the arbitrator is supposed to do? Decide what's the parameters of the document and his authority?
But the arbitrator, I believe, is limited by his jurisdiction, and that does not extend to implying inclusion of interest. The statute, which is a jurisdictional statute, it only allows enforcement of an express stipulation as to interest. And when the arbitrator implied interest, that went beyond his powers.
How is there an express? Can you point that out to me, what you're looking at?
Your Honor, it's in 661-8.
Okay. And 661-8 says, no interest shall be allowed on any claim. This is an arbitration case.
Yes, Your Honor.
Up to the time of rendition of judgment by the court. Was there a court rendition of judgment?
In arbitration cases, Your Honor, there is a judgment entered by the circuit court.
But that's the confirmation.
Yes, Your Honor. And it's my position that up until the confirming judgment entered by the circuit court, interest cannot be awarded. And in this case, the interest was on the back pay award. And prior to the entry of judgment, you cannot award
interest. So this statute invalidates any arbitration if against the state, any arbitration interest award?
Interest award, Your Honor. I would argue that...
That's putting a lot into that statute, aren't you?
I respectfully disagree, Your Honor. I think this statute, by its plain meaning, it applies to any claim, and the arbitration statutes refer to issues before the arbitrator as claims. It also applies to judgments, and in the arbitration statutes, a judgment is required, confirming judgment in circuit court.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, Mr. Nakasugi, but while you're on this point about the extent to which prejudgment interest would be awarded under Hawaii's statute, how do you distinguish the Hughes case?
Your Honor, the Hughes case, first of all, was in federal court interpreting state law, so it's not binding. But I would also argue that the Hughes case was wrongly decided. First of all, the Hughes case basically said that 661-8 doesn't apply to arbitrations. But again, there's nothing in 661-8 that says it does not apply to arbitrations. The words claim and judgment are used in arbitrations. So I don't think there's anything that prevents 661 from applying to arbitrations. More importantly, even if you accept what the Hughes court said, which is that 661-8 doesn't apply to arbitrations, that's only half the battle. Sovereign immunity exists. It's an inherent aspect of the sovereignty of states.
Well, right. And what is sovereign immunity?
Sovereign immunity is
immunity from suit.
Yes, Your Honor, but it also
this is not a suit. This is a contractual remedy that you agreed to.
Yes, Your Honor, but it extends to interest as well. And there are specific rules in sovereign immunity law applicable to interest.
Right. If it's a suit, Taylor Rice, it's a suit. It's a lawsuit.
Well, Your Honor, we're not contesting the arbitration itself. We're not contesting the principal award that was given to the grievant. In general, the state has waived our immunity as to participating in an arbitration.
But it's not an immunity. You agreed to resolve your disputes with the union, HSTA in this case, through arbitration.
Yes, Your Honor, but because of the special rules on interest.
What case says you can't award interest in an arbitration, please?
Well, Your Honor, the closest case that comes to specifically arbitrations is the UPW case. This is a decision decided by another ICA panel, which was an arbitration case, and the ICA actually applied sovereign immunity law. Sovereign immunity law based on Taylor Rice, based on Garner.
Which case was that again?
This was UPW versus Department of Public Safety. This is a 2009 ICA case from a different ICA panel.
And the reported citation?
It's unpublished, so it's...
Is it unpublished memo?
It is, Your Honor. It's number 28858. The Westlaw citation is 2009 WL. 180520, and it's attached to my brief, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But in any event, Your Honor, this is the case that deals with arbitrations, and it does apply sovereign immunity, specifically sovereign immunity as to prejudgment interest. It applies it to an arbitration case. In addition, there are many, many Hawaii cases on prejudgment interest and applying sovereign immunity.
Those were lawsuits, though, right? So this is the only authority you have for sovereign immunity applying to interest against the state in an arbitration?
This is the only case that I'm aware of that specifically...
Have you found anything from the federal scheme?
No, Your Honor, I have not.
And don't you think there's a lot of arbitrations all over the United States that deal with interest against a state and or federal...
Well, Your Honor, the federal
government
law is also very clear on interest. You need a specific waiver. There are Supreme Court cases, Library of Congress versus Shaw, for instance, That was specifically about interest and...
Is that arbitration cases?
It wasn't an arbitration case, Your Honor.
Right, that's the difference, right? I mean, this is not a lawsuit.
Your Honor, I would argue that when you're dealing with sovereign immunity, I don't think it particularly matters.
The concept of sovereign immunity applies to lawsuits, not to private agreements that the state reaches with contractual remedies that the state agrees to.
Your Honor, I would
from what
that,
I see,
that contracts they're limited by the law. You know, if there's a provision in the contract that is contrary to law,
actually, totally wrong. All the arbitration law is that it doesn't matter if the arbitrator makes terrible mistakes of law.
Well,
it's binding. I mean, the court can't touch it.
Your Honor, I again, respectfully disagree. The public policy exception, that applies to arbitrations. And if there is an arbitration decision that is contrary to public policy, then it is not entitled to deference.
Mr. Nakasuji, while you're on the public policy argument, maybe in response to Justice McKenna's question about the applicability of arbitration in other states, you could address the Alaska versus Alaska Public Employees Association, which was an arbitration that pertained to the termination of an employee where the court did consider sovereign immunity in the context of arbitration.
Yes, Your Honor. The Alaska case is different from our case because Alaska has a specific statute that is very different from ours. The Alaska case, in Alaska, basically, you can get interest against the state, and that's because of the specific Alaska statute. And if Alaska wants to waive sovereign immunity as to all interests, they certainly can. But Hawaii hasn't done that. Hawaii has only waived sovereign immunity as to interest with respect to contracts that expressly stipulate for interest, and we don't have that in this case. There's no express stipulation as to interest. You know, yes, Your Honor.
I want to kind of change tax a little bit. I'm interested in your argument regarding appellate fees and costs awarded by the ICA. Is it my understanding that your argument is that they are without authority to award it under 658A25?
Yes, Your Honor.
Explain your argument to me, how an appellate court, how the ICA exceeded its authority.
Well, Your Honor, first of all, 658A-1 defines court as a district or circuit court. It doesn't apply. Doesn't define it as an appellate court. And also, if you look at 658A-25, the proceedings that are addressed in that provision are specifically motions to confirm, motions to vacate, motions to modify, motions to correct. Those motions are not filed in appellate courts. Those are motions that take place in circuit court. And so 658A, it's talking about attorney's fees awarded by the circuit court specifically for circuit court proceedings. It doesn't apply to appeals.
658A1 says district or circuit court unless otherwise indicated. 658A25 says on application of a prevailing party to a contested judicial proceeding. How is a prevailing party determined when there's an appeal?
Your Honor, I would argue that...
Isn't it pretty clear that the prevailing party is not determined until the appeals are decided? There's an appeal?
Your Honor, I believe that the prevailing party would be the party that prevails in the proceedings in circuit court, specifically the motions to confirm, motions to vacate, etc.
So are you arguing that the revised Uniform Arbitration Act, Section 25, only intended to allow for attorney's fees for the trial court in which the motion is brought?
Yes, Your Honor. I would argue...
Have you looked at the commentary to the revised Uniform Arbitration Act?
I have not, Your Honor.
Well, there's a commentary, Section 3 to Section 25C, that specifically cites to a case in which allowed appellate fees.
Well, Your Honor, again, I would point out that the court is bound by the plain meaning of the statutes, and I would argue that the plain meaning here is limited to circuit court. And furthermore, I would argue that sovereign immunity applies to attorney's fees as well. And there's a principle in sovereign immunity law that if the waiver of sovereign immunity has to be strictly construed in favor of the state. So if there's any doubt here as to whether appellate attorney's fees are authorized, you have to rule in favor of the state. And in this case, there's significant doubt. There's nothing in the plain meaning of the statute applies to appellate attorney's fees. I would also argue, Your Honor, that where the statute refers to other proceedings, that's referring to enforcement proceedings in circuit court. There's actually a case, an ICA case, UPW, I cited in my application for cert, I believe, or at least in the motions and oppositions in the ICA. In that case, the ICA interpreted these provisions as applying to enforcement proceedings in circuit court, not to appellate proceedings.
Going back to the whether or not the interest could be awarded, why can't someone interpret the agreement that you made with the teachers where it says the arbitrator may award back pay to compensate the teacher wholly or partially for any salary loss? It's almost as if you're reading that to say the arbitrator may award back pay to compensate the teacher for salary loss. You're reading the word wholly, totally out of it. And our law is pretty clear that says prejudgment interest is an element of complete compensation. So it seems to me, even if I agreed with you on your statutory interpretation, it seems to me you've expressly waived it here by allowing a person to be. Otherwise, if the employee's not restored to what they would have been, it's clearly you are, even though this person was wrongly terminated, you're not restoring them to their official prior position.
Your Honor, the word wholly is not an express stipulation. The word wholly, you have to infer interest into the word wholly. It's not express. Express means that it's explicit, that it's not implied.
Wait a second. Wholly means you make the person whole. How do you make the person whole if you're not giving them what they would have had if they'd been properly paid?
Your Honor, I can understand your argument absent the requirement of an express stipulation. In my view, express really means express. It has to be specifically stated. It cannot be implied.
So then what does the word wholly mean?
Word wholly, I think, actually refers to back pay. If you read the sentence, they're talking about back pay. So I think it's saying that you have to give them back all the back pay that they should have been paid, but it doesn't mean interest.
Wasn't that issue addressed, and this is a pretty old case, a Rodriguez case, but in that case, the court, I think Justice Richardson wrote this one, and it was a 1970 case, but the issue of the meaning of wholly came up with respect to prejudgment interest, and I thought the court's decision there was that prejudgment interest by virtue of sovereign immunity, prejudgment interest was not going to be granted, notwithstanding the fact that the definition of wholly, I guess you could say a remedy that leaves the plaintiff whole would be incomplete. That the fact that it would be incomplete did not overcome the statutory requirement that was in 662-8 that prejudgment interest not be awarded.
Your Honor, I'm not familiar with that case, but I would simply say that
that was a case where there was damage from the overflow of some water, where there was a blocked culvert, and the court determined that prejudgment interest would not be allowed, despite the fact that the purpose of the damages was to restore the person wronged and make them whole.
Your Honor, it sounds like it supports my argument, and I'm grateful for you to point it out to me, but in any event, I would argue that just looking at the statute, just applying the plain meaning, applying sovereign immunity principles. You know, you have to have an express stipulation. And moreover, the general sovereign immunity principles support the requirement of an express stipulation. Sovereign immunity generally, again, the general rule is that if there's any doubt, you have to rule in favor of the state. The sovereign immunity has to be strictly construed in favor of the state. So if there's any doubt there, then the immunity has to be upheld. And the reason for that, Your Honor, is again, it's part of the sovereignty of states. The states are entitled to their dignity as sovereign entities.
So your position is we owe no deference whatsoever to the arbitrator. This is the standards that are ordinarily articulated as to whether an arbitrator's decision exceeds their power, you know, completely irrational, manifest disregard of the law, similar kinds of tests. Are utterly inapplicable, and we review this question de novo?
Yes, Your Honor. Just very briefly, on the deference issue, first of all, this is a jurisdictional issue, and the court does not have to defer to the arbitrator on a jurisdictional issue. And I base that on arbitration of the Board of Directors of the Association of Apartment Owners of Tropicana Manor and Jeffers. So the Jeffers case dealt with a jurisdictional issue, which was reopening a case after the final arbitration award. And the court didn't defer to the arbitrator. Court decided for itself that the arbitrator did not have jurisdiction. My second argument,
different question, whether the court or an arbitrator has authority to act on the matter before it. That's jurisdictional. But when the arbitrator makes a mistake of law, so assuming it were, and awards some sort of award, maybe where it's not warranted by the law, isn't that just a mistake of law that comes with the arbitration? The arbitrator still has jurisdiction over the matter.
On other issues, Your Honor, maybe, but again, this is subject matter jurisdiction. It's well settled that sovereign immunity is a subject matter jurisdiction issue. In addition, Your Honor, as for deference, the public policy exception applies.
So the arbitrator can't even decide whether the arbitrator has jurisdiction over the matter. I don't think, because under your definition, the arbitrator can't even decide whether or not sovereign immunity applies because he or she doesn't have jurisdiction over it. The arbitrator can decide that, right?
I would argue.
You wouldn't be arguing if they said no.
Your Honor, the arbitrator has jurisdiction over an arbitration case, but not jurisdiction to award interest. That's what his jurisdiction is.
Is this collective bargaining agreement the kind of standard collective bargaining agreement that we see in these public union contracts that says that the arbitrator decides arbitrability?
I don't know that, Your Honor.
Well, it's in, if the employer disputes the arbitrability of any grievance, the arbitrator shall first determine the question of arbitrability.
So under the contract that you signed, doesn't the arbitrator get to decide whether or not interest is allowable? We don't even have jurisdiction to decide the arbitrability of prejudgment interest.
Your Honor, the arbitrator certainly does have authority to decide these issues, but his authority is limited to on the issue of awarding interest.
You have contractually allowed him to decide what's arbitrable and what's not arbitrable. You have taken that out of our hands, the court's hands. You say the arbitrator gets to decide what is arbitrable. We can't even address if it's arbitrable or not.
Yes, Your Honor, but subject to the jurisdiction of the arbitrator. If the statutes take that out of his jurisdiction, it is beyond the arbitrator's power.
You're calling it jurisdiction, and I don't even think that's the correct word. It's authority, whether the person has the authority. They're not a court. They have the authority. You've given them the authority. They have the authority under this agreement to decide whether they can, it's subject matter of their arbitration. Once they decide, it only comes up to the court. The court determines whether or not it can vacate it, and this isn't one of the three reasons it's in the statute.
Well, Your Honor, I've run out of time.
It seems to me you're okay.
I mean, under your argument, would any issue related to, like, the amount of back pay, that would technically, it could be argued that impinges on the on the sovereign immunity of the state. So does that mean anything that involves a monetary award against the state that you can characterize as possibly infringing on our sovereign immunity? We no longer owe deference to the arbitrator?
No, Your Honor. The principal back pay award, we never challenged. And I would argue the arbitrator has authority to issue the principal award. Where the arbitrator's authority stops is the award of prejudgment interest.
But isn't our standard, and I gave you some federal standards before, Hawaii standards, so long as the arbitrator's interpretation could have rested on an interpretation and application of the agreement. Justice Pollack earlier read you the language which said the arbitrator may award back pay to compensate the teacher wholly or partially for any salary lost. Is it not at least a potential interpretation of the agreement that wholly there indicates make the individual whole, including through the award of interest? And if so, do we get to second guess that decision?
Your Honor, I would say no. I would say that the 661-8 supersedes that. It's 661-8 is a specific statute, and the specific statute governs over general ones. I'm out of time, Your Honors, and I reserve whatever time I have left.
Thank
for
you.
Rebuttal.
Thank you. Very well. Thank you. Ms. Covert.
Maybe I could first touch on some of the questions that were asked, particularly about the UPW case. And that was when you look at the facts, which are pretty slim in it. But what happened was, as noted in discerned from the decision, is that the union's position was that after the arbitrator issued his award, the employer did not pay on it. So it went into court to confirm the award, and it asked for pre-interest judgment from the date of the award to the judgment. It did not ask for pre-judgment interest from the date of the discipline of the employee when any pay stopped until the award. And there's also other cases decided by this court that makes a distinction between, in fact, they said if the court were to, it wasn't a sovereign immunity case, but it was an interest case, and the court was being asked by the party in the arbitration to not only take action on the award, but to award interest, pre-award interest. And the court said no under, I think this was under 658. So no, you know, we can look from the award date forward under 658, but we cannot do it previously because we would be modifying the award if we were to give you interest. So it's a roundabout way, but in UPW, the issue the union was seeking was not pre-award interest, but interest under the arbitration statute related to the award date through judgment.
Ms. Colbert, would you mind addressing the appellate attorney's fees and costs, please?
Yes.
When I look at 658A1, they define court. And they define court as meaning any district or circuit court of competent jurisdiction unless otherwise indicated. And I would submit under that language, 658A25C indicates that it's a court other than the district or circuit court.
By calling just a judicial proceeding?
By a judicial proceeding, and I think the point that was being made, I believe, by you, that how do you become a prevailing party if not at circuit court? And I believe also judicial proceeding after the award is made.
But the prevailing party they're referencing are sections 658A, 22, 23, or 24.
Right.
And those are actions, the prevailing party, it seems like, are what's already occurred at the arbitration, right?
Well, the prevailing, as I read C, and correct me if I'm not understanding your question, but as I read C, if I went in for a motion to confirm, it was awarded, and then the opposing counsel and the other party took it up on appeal, and I then had to defend that confirmation of that award. That is a judicial proceeding after the award is made to a judgment confirming, and therefore I would be entitled under 658A25C to attorney fees and costs
at the appellate level.
But it says in a judicial proceeding after the award is made to a judgment.
Yes.
So it appears that the judgment they're talking about is the judgment confirming vacating. In other words, you're entitled to the fees up to the judgment confirming or vacating, but I'm not so sure that that provision is clear as to after that judgment. In other words, it seems at least, maybe superficially, but the court may add the reasonable attorney fees and expenses occurred in a judicial proceeding after the award is made to a judgment confirming, to a judgment, not to an appeal or not to something else.
I look at B also, so it's a cost for trying to discern what is meant by this language. And the reference is cost of the motion and subsequent judicial proceedings. So I think the motion is the motion where you're going in to confirm or vacate, which would be, I think, the interpretation you're giving to that language in 658A, 25C.
But the cost...
Is,
go ahead,
Justin. Well, isn't that arguably... buttresses the state's argument because B would seem to explicitly recognize costs throughout, while C seems to refer only to the period of time between the proceeding being filed and the judgment being entered confirming it.
So the position you're questioning is the attorney fees and costs limited to what you had to expend to confirm the award?
Yes,
correct.
As
yes.
opposed to on the appeal.
Right.
And I would suggest that it is not limited to that.
Oh, do you need a moment? If you'd like, we'll just take a brief break to... Is that okay? Are you all right?
You're okay for a minute.
Okay, if it bothers you anymore, just let us know. We can take a recess.
What would disallowing appellate fees do? I mean, when I look at the commentary to Section 25 of the Revised Uniform Arbitration Act, it says... Potential liability for the opposing parties' post-award litigation expenditures will tend to discourage all but the most meritorious challenges of arbitration awards. So it appears that the purpose of allowing attorney's fees under 285C of the Revised Uniform Arbitration Act is to discourage litigation. In other words, try to get people to comply with the arbitration award. And the case that is cited by the commentary is if a party prevails in a contested judicial proceeding over an arbitration award, Section 25C allows the court discretion to award attorney's fees and litigation expenses. And it cites to a case called Blitz v. Bath Isaac Adas Israel Congregation, 352 Maryland 31, 728 2nd 912, 1998, permitting award of attorney's fees in both the trial and appeal of an action to confirm and enforce an arbitration award against party who refused to comply with it.
Yes.
So it appears that the purpose of 25C is to allow the prevailing party in an arbitration that has gotten a confirmation to collect attorney's fees and costs.
I agree, and we've cited that case when we made these arguments for attorney fees post the award confirming or vacating, and for that very reason. In fact, one of the changes between 658 and 658A and one of the changes between the Uniform Arbitration Act and the Revised Uniform Arbitration Act was to put in the fees and costs provisions specifically for what you've just read, which is to deter these proceeding litigation where the entire intent of the parties was to remove litigation from these disputes, get to a final and binding award, and everybody just has to go back to the table and negotiate something different if they didn't like it, as opposed to trying to litigate
but
it.
If that's true, and they knew exactly why they were doing it, why would they define court to mean any district or circuit court unless otherwise indicated? I mean, where is it otherwise indicated? I mean, if they define it, where does it indicate that it means something else, an appellate court?
Well, we would submit that as indicated is that if you're going to apply applicant prize or prevailing party to a contested judicial proceeding,
that you would be having to go even beyond just the circuit court level to the appellate level in order to achieve the purpose of this section, which is to deter extended and lengthy litigation over an award.
And Ms. Colbert, I'm looking at C again, and it seems like the sentence, the last sentence, can be divided in different ways. Are they talking about reasonable expenses of litigation that are incurred after the award, or to award the reasonable, after the award, then you can award reasonable expenses of litigation? Do you know what I mean?
Not quite.
The court may add reasonable attorney's fees and other reasonable expenses of litigations incurred in a judicial proceeding after the award is made. So could it mean that you get additional attorney's fees and costs that were incurred on appeal? Because it was after the award was made.
Yes. That is how we have viewed this language, as the ability to achieve the intent of the section, irrespective of the fact that the section itself does not say end to appellate courts. But the problem is that often on a motion to confirm or vacate, that's just the first level. If it takes it to an appellate level, then you have many more hours of litigation and costs incurred and fees, which would be contrary to the intended purpose of the statute. And under the canons of construction, we would submit the court should take that into consideration in interpreting this language as drafted.
And even if, getting back to the prior point, even if the circuit court grants the motion to confirm, if there's an appeal, the prevailing party is not determined until the appellate proceedings are concluded.
That is correct. And you would also be the prevailing party on the appeal, where you were not the prevailing party below, and yet you have incurred now as a party two levels of litigation and no relief for attorney fees and costs, separate from the intended purpose, which was to deter the appeals.
What if the appeal goes the other way? Then what happens with regard to the fees up to that point?
You'd have to pay them back, you mean? So if I got a motion to confirm, I went in for attorney fees and costs, the court granted my motion to confirm, gave me my attorney fees and costs, supposing
the other side appeals and they prevail on the appeal, do you still get your attorney's fees and costs or not?
No.
Because that would be vacated at that point.
Do they get
their attorney's fees and costs on appeal?
Well, they can move for it. I think it's still discretionary on the court, so.
So, Ms. Colbert, is it your position that it's clear that if this matter was decided in court rather than arbitration, prejudgment interest would not be available?
If this matter were decided in a court, you mean if the parties had negotiated that in their grievance process, the final decision would be made by a court?
Well, I'm supposing a situation in which there's a wrongful termination claim that's litigated in court and the plaintiff prevails. In that situation, you would concede that prejudgment interest wouldn't be available, right? And so it's your position that the public policy exception wouldn't apply here in the sense of assigning such significance to a sovereign immunity that it would be a public policy of such significance that it could not, unless expressly waived, it could not be waived.
On the public policy exception, when I look at, and I think I take to heart what was some of the questions during the counsel's argument, is that the arbitrator, even if he gets it totally wrong, its award is not vacated on that basis.
Well, so that policy you think would take precedence over the policy that suggests that sovereign immunity isn't waived unless expressly waived? Because in this case, I mean, sovereign immunity for prejudgment interest obviously isn't addressed in the collective bargaining agreement, right?
They don't address sovereign immunity, no.
Right. And one reason I'm raising this is because of the nature of the discussion in the case of State versus Alaska Public Employees Association, because you'll recall in that case the court was somewhat uncomfortable about finding that prejudgment interest could be awarded, but part of the reason it decided to award prejudgment interest, despite the fact that there didn't seem to be an express waiver of sovereign immunity, was, as Mr. Nakasugi pointed out, there were statutory policies represented by decisions, legislative enactments that allowed for prejudgment interest in situations involving contract claims, for example.
Well, I think that court still entertained that there was a sovereign immunity that required specific language to allow interest, and they still found that, wait a minute, how could you get to arbitration and agree to that the arbitrator will make a binding decision and yet can slip out of it by alleging sovereign immunity and the interest. So they found that it was not compatible with the arbitration setting. I think in the there was the Alaska case, there was also in the Kenneth Hughes, I think the court found that a claim, arbitration is not a claim under 661.8. There may be some disagreement on that, but it still has to go to a court for at the point that you're looking for the interest, which is what I've been arguing, is that if the union had, HSTA had come in and asked for interest from the date of the arbitrator's award forward, that would be a different matter. But in this case, you have the parties agreed. They sat across the table, they shook hands, they said, we'll agree to binding arbitration, we'll agree to the arbitrator deciding the issues, we'll agree that the arbitrator will decide the remedy, we'll agree that we'll make the employees whole.
Well, that, as I mentioned, I think the idea that an employee is not going to be made whole unless prejudgment interest can be awarded, obviously, is addressed by 662. I mean, that's not the public policy of the state of Hawaii. If the matter's decided in court, if you will, the idea is that an individual in court that receives an award doesn't get prejudgment interest, and you either assume that they are whole, despite the fact they didn't get prejudgment interest, or there's a public policy in favor of them not being completely whole that would suggest that prejudgment interest is so important that it won't be awarded despite the fact the plaintiff won't be whole.
I think the situation you're giving, where an employee gets terminated and goes to court, you don't have, unless there's a statute that uses the word wholly, you don't get that. Reinstated and some damages that the court will determine based on the law, the statute, whatever it may be. But in the Rio Pell versus Massachusetts, which is a federal case from 1991 that we cited, and that one raised a sovereign immunity issue. It wasn't an arbitration, but the statute talked about compensating an employee. And they said because of the veteran, I guess it was. So they said because of the word compensation, the use of compensating them, their reasoning was how can you compensate without interest to make them fully compensated? The statute didn't even have the word fully, but the court read that into it and found that sovereign immunity did not apply. But the doctrine of sovereign immunity is specific to interest, needing a specific provision, did not apply because the intent of the statute, and you would undermine the intent of the statute if you did not compensate them. The collective bargaining agreement goes even further, has wholly compensate.
But what about the argument that we don't owe deference to the arbitrator's interpretation in these circumstances because it's sovereign immunity? Well, ordinarily, you know, we have a very deferential standard for review of the arbitrator's determinations and interpretation of the agreement. In this instance, that very deferential review doesn't apply because we're talking about sovereign immunity, and there it has to be a very express waiver, which doesn't exist in the collective bargaining agreement. What's your response to that argument?
I have a couple of different responses to that. If I can, which hasn't been touched on, I would touch on 658A21C. Because when I look at 661, the chapter, it's civil, and it's courts. You look at the 661-1 is the courts. You look at 661-2, it's also talking specifically about courts. So when you get 661-5, I think, is also about bringing your claims to court, and then you get to 661-8 that talks about your claims at the court. So that's where the sovereign immunity interest is in your 661-8. That's what the court is restricted by.
I'm trying to follow your argument. But when you look at 662-2, is there a reason why you feel that that's just meant to apply to court? Is it because it's talking about liability for torts? Is that the idea? It says, the state hereby waives its immunity for liability for the torts of its employees and shall be liable in the same manner and to the same extent as a private individual under like circumstances, but shall not be liable for interest prior to judgment or for punitive damages. So your view is that 662 only applies to court actions. 662-2?
662-2? I was looking at 661-2, sorry. That's under the tort liability. So I wasn't looking at the tort liability. I was looking at the 661, which is the actions fine against the state. And 661-1 jurisdiction is the several circuit courts in the state. And
you know, the state cites to this Alaska case saying that it's distinguishable because Alaska has a statute. But it's pretty clear that the Alaska Supreme Court ruled on the basis of waiver of sovereign immunity based on arbitration. It wasn't based on the statute. The Alaska Supreme Court ruled based on the fact that states' consent to arbitration amounts to an express waiver of sovereign immunity to the extent needed to make a claimant whole by awarding prejudgment interest. And in this case, the arbitrator had awarded the prejudgment interest. And
I agree. I do not believe that it can be distinguished on that basis. But the 658A21C provides that an arbitrator award will not be vacated because his remedy is something that a circuit court could not award. So when you talk about this public policy, I think and needing the specific language about the interest, I think you have to take a step back and look at, in the context of 658A and an arbitrator, you still give their deference in their remedy. In fact, when you get to remedy, that is the greatest area of deference to an arbitrator.
And so you would defer to the arbitrator's decision if the arbitrator had also refused to grant prejudgment interest?
Unfortunately, we would, yes. We would be sad he did that, but we'd have to accept that. And, you know, and he could do it wholly or partially, because that's what we agreed to over the table. And, you know, and when you start talking about public policy, you've got Chapter 89 and good faith bargaining, and I don't see any good faith bargaining but the employer agreeing to live with an arbitrator's award, agreeing to wholly compensate an employee, and then the minute the award includes interest, they start raising sovereign immunity. That's not good faith bargaining.
How much was the award here? Like $38,000 or so for back pay?
I think it was $25,000 to $35,000, somewhere in there. I haven't looked at that in a while.
Anything further?
I did want to touch on the procedural issue, and
very well.
My comments on that were that procedurally what the ICA, as I understood what the ICA was doing, is that there was a judgment, the court even stamped on it the language you need for a Jenkins final judgment, and there was no motion to reconsider. And about that,
wasn't there a motion within 10 days?
Yes, it has to be filed within 10 days.
Wasn't there a motion within 10 days?
Not to. We filed a motion to reconsider. Yes.
Right.
But the employer did not file the motion to reconsider within 10 days.
Why does your filing the motion open up the judgment to being amended or modified, even if in favor of the employer?
When I looked at that, the employers at that point, it was their responsibility to go in on their own motion to amend the judgment. I wouldn't agree that our motion then relieved them from seeking it, because what we were seeking was not to alter the confirmation, but over the language of the order that dumped in a lot of language from the arbitrator's compliance.
But under Sukuma, once a motion is filed, I didn't agree with Sukuma, but once a motion is filed, the judgment is not final until an order is entered by the court. Mm-hmm. So the judgment was not final, regardless of who filed the motion, right?
That's, I think, the reasoning that the opposing counsel is raising.
Very well. Anything further at this point?
If I have just a moment.
No, absolutely. I'm not. Absolutely.
I would point out in the Jeffers case, which is what the employer relied on for arguing that the arbitrator lacked, he had exceeded his authority, was based on this subject matter jurisdiction issue. And I don't believe they can cite to that case for the holding that they're arguing it for. In Jeffers, it went on to note that the ARB exceeded his powers when he reopened the incident case. So there were language of finality of an award, which goes to, and there was no agreement of the parties to entertain motions to reconsider once an arbitrator issued his award. So the language that it's discussing, I mean, the sections of the doctrines of legal concept that it's applying were specific to an arbitrator's actions once a decision is made, as opposed to a 661-8, which is the language of a sovereign immunity, and where the parties have given the arbitrator the ability to establish the remedy to wholly compensate the employee. We would submit that the arbitrator was interpreting the contract at that point, and the deference is paid to the arbitrator.
Very well. Anything else at this time? Very well. Thank you very much, Ms. Covert. Mr. Nakatsuchi.
Just very briefly, Your Honor, addressing some of the issues that were raised in with Ms. Covert. Justice Wilson, I think, is wrestling with the idea of whether sovereign immunity applies to courts or also applies to arbitrations. And I think that question actually has been answered by the U.S. Supreme Court in Federal Maritime Commission versus South Carolina Ports Authority. That was a case dealing with whether sovereign immunity extends beyond the courts and applies to administrative tribunals. And the court said yes. And that's because sovereign immunity is based on protecting the dignity of the state. So it doesn't really matter what the forum is. What matters is that the state is a party. And in this case, we're dealing with arbitrations. That's true. But again, based on Federal Maritime Commission, sovereign immunity should extend to arbitrations as well. In addition, Your Honor, I would like to point out that arbitration awards are not enforceable until you get to court. You gotta get them confirmed by a court. So ultimately, the court is involved. So again, you know, even if you think that courts can't do something in violation of sovereign immunity, well, the court eventually has to get involved in an arbitration case. Now, regarding the procedural issues, the HSTA now is saying that the motion to alter or amend that they filed doesn't open up the judgment. And I would argue that it does open up the judgment. It makes the judgment no longer final, and so then it's interlocutory and subject to modification. Moreover, in the proceedings in this case, in the circuit court, the parties understood that the judgment was being opened to include the remaining issues, including the interest issues. In fact, I quote an exchange in my cert pleadings where Ms. Covert actually asks the judge, should we add the interest in too? And the judge says yes. So in these proceedings, it's irrelevant that HSTA filed the motion. Everybody understood that the remaining issues had to be added to the judgment, including interest, also including attorney's fees. There were attorney's fees proceedings that were added to the judgment as well, although attorney's fees are not an issue on appeal because HSTA didn't argue that. Well, in closing, Your Honors, I would like to just thank the court for granting cert and allowing me to be here. I was actually worried that this case would be resolved purely on the procedural issue that the ICA seemed to focus on. So I'm just grateful to have the opportunity to argue the merits, whatever the court decides. I am grateful for the opportunity because I do believe this is a very important issue. We're really dealing with two bodies of law, and there's a conflict there. And we do need an answer on that conflict.
Do you agree that the Alaska court decided based on the waiver of sovereign immunity due to agreeing to arbitration?
I believe, Your Honor, the Alaska court decided it based on the statutes that Alaska has passed that waive sovereign immunity. Our statutes are different.
Have you read the case? It's pretty clear that they ruled based on the arbitration, not based on the statute. Perhaps. Thank you.
There's nothing further. Thank you, Your Honor.
Very well. Thank you to both of our attorneys here today. The court will take this matter under advisement.